The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
By the way, one quick story while you're coming out the door. Take a look on your right. You'll see a menorah. That menorah was returned by a grateful Arab patient whose life was saved by a cardiologist who lives here on Kfar Etzion, who works in Hadassah, and he said, I have a gift for you. And he brought him back a menorah that had been looted from Kfar Etzion in 1948. And they started to clean it. And thank God somebody caught them and stopped them, said, don't take the wax out, because that wax was from the Hanukkah candles that were lit here in this kibbutz in 1948. And since then, they've also, in a similar story, got back a Shabbos candelabra.
It's amazing.
Amba, why can we not go inside and look inside?
Inside where?
Inside.
In the bunker?
Yeah.
Because if everybody went inside the bunker all the time, they'd mess it up.
Wait,
a lot of people come here. But I'll show you something cool that you'll like.
I want to go inside and look at the hole.
See that? That's what? A real tank from 1948.
What?
An armored car. It's like a remnant of a truck. You ever see one of those?
Can you show me that?
We're going there now. Just real quick while we wait for the stragglers. Just a couple things I wanted to show you before we get back on the bus and head towards lunch. The reason I stopped here, in 1995-96, when they gave over, at least temporarily, control of Beit Lechem to the Palestinian Authority, you can imagine that was a very, very difficult experience for the survivors and the children of the survivors of Gush Etzion, because their loved ones had fallen in defense of Gush Etzion. Some of them, many of them, had died in Beit Lechem at Nebi Daniel, at the convoy, that first convoy that you saw, when the Arabs were laying siege to Gush Etzion. So convoys with food, medical supplies, that had to come through Beit Lechem. And what they did was they had a barricade buster in the front, which was sort of at the front of an armored car, point like this, and just in case. And they made it through without incident. They got to Kfar Etzion. They unloaded enormous amounts of supplies. The Israelis had decided to go all out and make a huge convoy. Okay, a quarter of all the armored cars in the entire country were dedicated in this convoy. They made it in without incident. When they were coming back, they had an interesting technical difficulty. There was a bull, a stud bull. You know, even though there was a war on, their dream was to build a farming community, an agricultural community that they could build and farm. So, you know, if you're going to have dairy cows, you need to have a bull that does what a bull does to make more cows, right? And this bull leads a very happy life, and it's being taken around the country to spend a week here on vacation, and a week there on vacation, etc., right? So this bull had done what it was meant to do here in the kibbutz, and now it was wanted. You know, a bull was very expensive. They didn't have that many in Israel, so they were taking it up north. They could not get the bull onto the truck. This is not, by the way, the beginning of a one-line joke. They couldn't get the bull on the truck. It took them 3 hours to get this bull up onto the armored truck. By that time, the Arabs, who had seen them pass through the morning, knew they were coming back. So this time they were ready for them. And they threw barricades down all across the road. They broke through the first three. The fourth one caught them outside a house known as Nebi Daniel, the house of Daniel. It's a whole other story. They were surrounded. Thousands of Arabs came pouring out of the hills, and basically they had to get out of the armored cars and take refuge in the house there. They had a radio. They were able to radio the British that they were in trouble. Now the British technically, this is before the State of Israel, the British technically were responsible. They were the police. But in certain areas they were decidedly pro-Arab. It took the British 24 hours to arrive on the scene. 1 year before I went into the army, I wanted to see, you know, sort of what it would be like to run to Jerusalem back in the days of being in better shape. So I actually woke up one morning and jogged to Jerusalem. It took about 2 hours, and I ran through Beit Lechem, because back then you could do that, right? I ran through Beit Lechem, and I passed the site of Nebi Daniel, and then it took me about 15 minutes of jogging to get to the Taggart Fortress that was the British base. In other words, they were a 15-minute jog from the site of this convoy, but it took them 24 hours to get there. Now, why did they have these armored cars? Because technically speaking, you know, police force should have been policing the roads. The British had a very strange sense of equality. Someone came up with a brilliant idea. How do you stop a war? How do you stop a war? Assuming that you're the British and you're policing things, and you can show up if there's a problem. Very simple. Make sure that only one side has arms. If only one side has arms, then how much can they fight with each other, right? So the Arabs all declare, many Arabs declare that their occupation was hunter. So they had hunting rifles. That's why you see them with all these hunting rifles. And therefore they were allowed legally to carry guns. The Jews made no such claim, and it was illegal for Jews to carry guns. In fact, in these armored cars, women would often carry pistols hidden in their shirts. Because they could get through sort of, you know, relying on the genteel nature of some of the British officers. And what they did in order to protect themselves was they armored these vehicles. These are homemade. They used to take Chevy vans, okay, pickup trucks, and put homemade armor on them. Okay, this is iron. When we walk up there, feel this. This is incredibly heavy. And what this did was to slow down. First of all, it was an oven. I mean, in the summer, you would sit inside these things. All this was closed. There were two slats that came down here. You could see out of a narrow slat. Okay? It was like an oven in there. They didn't have air conditioning back then, right? And the fastest one of these could do, when it had all this armor on, going up a hill, was about 7 or 8 miles. And it's an hour, which is basically parking speed for us. So that's how they had to drive from Jerusalem here. So what today takes is a 10-minute ride, took them about 3 hours. The convoy that went from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem took them about 10 hours. To get up the roads. And you imagine, it gives the Arabs a lot of time, and you don't have that feeling of, I'm in a car, I'll rush by. You're just forced to drive slow and just wait for it to come. So they brought one of these armored cars here because of where we are in this whole story that, you know, should serve as a memorial. Questions? Come on, I want to show you something else. And then we're going to head to the bus, yeah? That's part of the armored car. It fell off. Probably because kids were jumping on it. This is actually an archive that's part of the Museum of sort of the Man in the Mountain, they call it, which has archives of the writings of the people who lived here and those who fell and whatnot. And I don't usually take a group in here. I don't think we'll go in, but I'll take a look in a second to see if it's open. But that's not really why I brought you here. What I really brought you here was because of this. You stay in the shade. I'll just show you, okay? This is all stuff that was discovered sort of when they were rebuilding Kfar Etzion, okay? As an example, all right? When we go, walk by here, you'll see that there's a menorah engraved into the stone here, okay? This was the headstone for a synagogue, because that's where they put menorahs back then. There was a Jewish community that was here back in the year 2000, okay? And we have come home to rebuild where Jews once lived. Okay, 2,000 years ago, the Roman armies poured through these mountains, okay, and Jews were forced to leave, killed, exiled, and it took 2,000 years for their descendants to come back home. Okay, this is an ossuary, alright? An ossuary was the way they used to bury Jews back in the time of the Mishnah. What they did was they laid a body out on limestone. The limestone caused the body to decay rapidly, and you were left with the bones. And then the bones were gathered, and they were placed in a coffin like that, an ossuary. Right? And the reason they did that was because generally people were buried in caves, and there was a premium of space. It was a lot of work to dig down into the ground. They didn't have bulldozers back then. And so this way they could save space. But the absolute most amazing, there are Roman relics here, there's a millstone. The absolutely most amazing thing here is actually this. This is an amazing thing. Let me tell you what this is, okay? In 1948, okay? In 1948, in the 40s, when they were building, okay, the first settlement of Kfar Etzion, okay, in the 40s, so they were digging up the area, and they found this. Okay, this is a Roman column. This was built absolutely by Jewish slaves after the fall of the Jewish kingdom to the Roman Empire. The beginning of the darkest period in Jewish history, which ended up being almost 1900 years, separated from our homes, distant from our country. The Romans, which became the Roman Catholic Empire, overwhelmed what was then Judea, and the Jewish people were basically a downtrodden people for 2,000 years. This was part of a structure that was clearly Roman. This carbon dated back to about the year 220 CE, right? And it was, given the history that we know, pretty much absolutely built by Jewish slaves. Now, they didn't know this, but when they came back here, somebody found this and came up with a great idea. They attached this metal piece, and they used it as a mini steamroller to help flatten out the dirt paths and build the roads. And when we came back after the Six-Day War, they found this lying in a corner somewhere. The Jordanians just thrown it in a corner. So they put it on display. Think about this. We've taken the Roman Empire, and we're using it to build our kibbutzim. The same things that were built to subjugate us and kick us out of our home have now become the vehicle for allowing us to come back home 2,000 years later. This, to me, is Jewish history in a nutshell. You know? But I got one more thing to show you. Yeah. Come follow me one last thing before we get on the bus. If you look over there, you'll see that pagoda?
Yes.
So that is an exact replica that was built of the original butka that they used to sit and learn in. Remember that picture? They're sitting and learning Torah in the movie? So that's why they built it. And they built it on the exact spot that they used to sit and learn, overlooking these hills. One more thing I want to show you. Yeah.
You're allowed to dig up graves and move bodies? I mean,
for the right purpose.
Really?
It's called likut atzamot. For example, suppose you decide you come into a lot of money, you decide you want to rebury your family members in Israel.
Right, yeah, that's all on me.
Or let's say you want to rebuild and bury them in Yerushalayim.
Right, right.
You have to have a good reason.
Right.
But that's considered a good reason.
Uh-huh.
All right, can you hear me just real quick? Because, I mean, there's a lot to see on this kibbutz, which is good because it means maybe you'll come back and visit on your own.
That's really amazing.
We couldn't leave her without seeing this. This is a 2,500-year-old olive press. Who was saying olive press? See, I told you you'd get right. Just there's no when, right? 2,500 years old. This is from the period 2,400 years old. This is from the period of Beit Sheni, the Second Temple period. Okay? And this is another sort of the pieces of evidence that demonstrate that this was a living, thriving community over 2,000 years ago. The two major industries in these hills were oil, olive presses. We've discovered hundreds and hundreds of them, even in the caves underground. We won't get there, but if you go to the valley below Gush Etzion, you get to an area called Beit Jubrin, which is about a 15-minute ride from here, and there are thousands of caves underground. The Jews went underground after the Bar Kokhba rebellion because they were being hunted down, and you find caves with whole olive presses set up in the caves because that was their industry, right? And basically the way it worked, stay back so you stay in the shade, but the way it worked was that a donkey, or an ox, would pull this and turn it around. This obviously is not from the original press, right? The olives were placed in here, the shmarim, and this heavy stone would crush what was in the olives, and that was how you produce the oil. That was the second stage. The first stage, for those of you who know a little portion of the week, in the portion of Tetzaveh, it says that when you light the candles in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple, you're supposed to light Shemen Katit, Shemen Zayit Zach. It's supposed to be pure olive oil, Katit. What's Katit? Katit means the first drop of oil that comes out of the olive. That's considered the purest. And that was the only part, only oil that was used here. That was the only oil that was used for the menorah in the temple, right? And the way that was done was actually through weight. And still the way you make quality olive oil today, you take olives, you lay them out on a mat, you take another mat on top, more olives, another mat, and then you take a heavy stone and you place it, or heavy mats, on top, and over a period of a number of days, the weight gradually squeezes the olive so that the olive isn't damaged at all, but the drops come out. Right? Why did it take 8 days, 7 days really, to make the oil? It took that long to make the oil because that's how long it takes the weight to squeeze out those drops of oil. And then you have to have enough presses so that you can produce enough oil. I mean, imagine how much, right? And then you have to have enough oil to light the menorah, right? So there's actually a commentary in the Gemara on the Talmud that talks about how they actually produced the olive oil for example, the Hanukkah story, and how many olive presses you needed to produce the oil for the temple every day. Now, what's really amazing is that the story of Hanukkah happened in the year 165 before the Common Era. The rebellion began in 168. The actual Hanukkah miracle occurred in the year 165. That's when we know historically, okay, Yonatan HaMaccabee and the remainders of his forces succeeded in coming out of the mountains, retaking Yerushalayim, and rededicating the temple. This olive press is much older than that. It's at least 200 years older, which means that this was a working olive press in a Jewish community at the time of Hanukkah. And for all I know, oil from this olive press could easily have been oil that was used in the miracle of Hanukkah. At the very least, it's almost a guarantee that the oil from this olive press, because the katit oil was only used in the temple, and it was very valuable, and any olive press would produce katit oil so that they could sell it to the temple. So oil from this olive press found its way to the Beit HaMikdash, to light the menorah. The whole concept of the fact that in the middle of a war, with all the fighting and the horrific experiences that you're having, that an army comes and that all they want to do is to light a menorah, is just an unbelievable image. Because that's all we've ever really been about. And when you think about 1967, we came back here and they were expecting a battle. They retook Beit Lechem, Hebron, this whole area. And when they came out here, right, on the fourth day of the Six-Day War, you know what they found? They found the color white. From every window, every rooftop, they hung out pillowcases, white sheets, white flags. Because the Arabs here were terrified because they knew what they'd done to us in 1929, in 1936, and especially in 1948. And they were sure that we would come here and we would do what most normal armies would do, which is to rape and butcher and loot your way through town, especially after what they did to us. You know, just read accountings of what the Russians did to German towns that they retook in 1945. But when the Jews came here, it didn't interest them. There was not a single Arab civilian killed in the battle for Gush Etzion in the Six-Day War. Not one. Which is unbelievable. They came back, and all they wanted to do was to rebuild. And in their rebuilding, they discovered this. And so now they've made it a part of the story. What you do with this information, well, that's your call. Okay? So we're going to head back towards the bus. Any questions? Pardon? Oh, that's interesting. In 1948, they actually decided that they were going to make this into a working olive press. So they put that there to squeeze the mats. They figured out a way to speed up the process. And every day they would come and turn it another turn, and they would squeeze the mats, and so the olive oil would be produced more quickly, but you have to do it at a certain pace. So they found this still standing here, you know, after the Six-Day War. By the way, almost the entire kibbutz here was completely destroyed. The actual area where most of the 250 fighters in Kfar Etzion fell is behind those buildings over there, which today is a field near what is now the synagogue, which is beautiful, right? And all of this has been planted since. There are a few buildings that remain because this was a Jordanian base. And there was a Jordanian position up here. And you can actually still see the marker of the Jordanian Legion there. They took the old Jordanian barracks. Nobody who came back to the kibbutz wanted to live there. They didn't want to move back into a Jordanian barracks of the men who had killed their fathers. So they turned it into a greenhouse. And all the gardening that's done in the kibbutz is produced in the place which was once a Jordanian army barracks, which I find to be poetic, you know? And one last thing that's worth mentioning, which is the trees are, Baruch Hashem, in full bloom, but on a winter day when you can see through, you can actually see down to the valley below, and all the orchards and the fields that were once owned by Kfar Etzion and Ein Tzurim are now being farmed again. They found the original plantings. In other words, the trees, which weren't cultivated, nobody was working those fields, but the trees didn't die because there's a lot of rainfall here in the winter. So now they've reestablished the same plantings that their parents, brothers, sisters planted are now being worked by their children and grandchildren, which I also find to be amazing. What happened to the Jordanians? They surrendered. The Jordanians returned to Jordan. Yeah, yeah. There was actually a POW exchange, because there were Israelis taken prisoner. With Jordan, it proved to be not an issue. In fact, in 48, with the exception of the 250 that were killed here, all of the other three settlements here that fell, there were about 1,000 people, were taken prisoner and taken to Jordan in a POW camp. They languished there for about a year, and eventually all of them were returned after a year. And with the exception of the first week of interrogations, the general report was that although conditions were hard, you know, it wasn't a hotel, but they were not mistreated in Jordan. Jordan was never quite Egypt or Syria, because they were not fundamentalist Arab. In fact, the rulership of Jordan is not Palestinian, it's Bedouin. And that's a different culture. They have a history and a heritage of being very fierce fighters, but being very hospitable to guests. Once you become their guest, It's a different mindset.
Set up down to Ashkelon instead of back here?
Well, after 48, remember, the men of Masoret Yitzchak, Ein Tzurim, and Rivadim,
right.
They all survived.
Right.
So they wanted to, it'd be like, you know, what's going to happen after they move, I hope not, Gush Katif.
Right.
So you got a whole community that lives together, that loves each other. They don't want to just move into Tel Aviv. They got used to a beautiful lifestyle.
They didn't come back here.
Right, so they wanted to find land. So they were given land. Well, because this was Jordan in 48. So they went and found they were given land, and they went
and
farmed Ashkelon. Right.
Only
this was all Jordan after 48. No, this whole place
after
fell 48. In
48. Including the people from Masoret Yitzchak.
Right, it all fell. The people from Masoret Yitzchak and Radim and Insurim were taken prisoner.
Right.
And the people from Kfar Etzion, with the exception of four people, were killed.
Right.
Right. And then in 67, 19 years later, well, they'd already established, you know, the people who had these places over there. Masoret Yitzchak, you know what, remind me, I'm going to say this on the bus, because it's a good point.
There are people living here now.
Yeah.
There is.
Oh yeah, this is a living, active, thriving kibbutz. It's just that because we were a little late, we didn't have a chance to walk through the kibbutz, but it's beautiful. There are about 160 families, I think. Come, we'll walk this way, we'll meet them at the gate, you'll get to walk through the kibbutz. Come. By the way, the original Beit Midrash, the original house of study that they used to study in the midst of all the fighting, they insisted they continued to have shiurim, classes, learning, by the way, not just in Torah, in history of the land of Israel, botany, and they did it here. And when all the men were killed, the library was burned, the Beit Midrash and the synagogue that were here were completely burned. So when they came back, they rebuilt this. This has just finally been finished. It's called Neve Ovadia. Okay, it was named after the fellow who was the Gabbai here and who really founded it. This over here on your left is one of the Jordanian army barracks that was a Quonset hut that was set up here. And this is the marker that marks this. This was at the front of the kibbutz that marked this as a Jordanian base. That's the King's Crown of Jordan. And they didn't want to live here for obvious reasons, so they turned it into a greenhouse. And all the plants and the flowers on the kibbutz are produced in what was once a Jordanian army barracks. Cool, huh?
This is where they laid out the...
This is gorgeous. Just one last detail, which is that that last day, a lot of the heavy fighting... Remember she says that they're in the bunker and all the heavy fighting is taking place outside? Took place in this open field.
Wow.
And that's why they decided to build a playground here. But the day will come when the fields of battle will turn into the playgrounds of the children. And you think about what was here and what is here. This to me is like a microcosm of Israel. Like, we don't want war. We just want to be able to live under our vines with our children. And if we could only somehow find a way to create that dialogue, the world would be a different place. This, by the way, is a great example. This is a bomb shelter. It's an unfortunate reality in this country that it's actually the law. When you build a house, you have to have a room. That's a protected room. Every community has a bomb shelter. And of course, this was built in 67, so in the kibbutzim they had lots of bomb shelters. But they took to decorating them. This one actually is a sort of a synagogue. So like the quickie afternoon minyan, if you don't want to go to the main synagogue, you know, where the sermon's taking place, right? And you'll find the kids decorating bomb shelters, which I think is a whole message in and of itself. Ah, there you go. That's in case the rabbi bombs, right? This is the kibbutz dining room, by the way. That way the kids can play while the parents eat. Smart, huh? This is the sukkah. Yeah, we gotta get these guys to build ours. This is a big sukkah. By the way, you know what's interesting? Kibbutz life is a very simple way of life. Everybody gets the same house. There's no, like, you know, you built this way, you built that way. You don't have to worry about building a house. You get the same thing. However many people you have. I admire it. I could never live that way, but I do admire it. Want to smell something really good? Don't pick it. Just run your hands along it.
Oh, yeah,
and make a blessing. Baruch atah necholam os borei atzei b'samim.
Yisvei b'samim.
Yeah, it's a very specific, but a very beautiful way of life. You know? There's certain parts of it that I would personally find tough, but... You know, your child doesn't just have two brothers and sisters. He's got, like, you know, 120. I mean, everybody here is like family.
But the people who live on the kibbutz, do they work outside of the kibbutz?
Some work outside of the kibbutz. Yes, sweetheart? Some work in the kibbutz?
Five
days. Yeah, but we're going to be in an air-conditioned bus in 1 minute. I want to get a little feeling of walking the land.
Why can't I put it here?
Because I don't want it to bang around.
What?
Yeah, I don't want that either.
Why?
So I don't want you holding a machine gun.
I won't shoot it.
What? Now you feel you got your hike for the day?
Yes.
You coming to Masada tomorrow? It's warm down there. Don't wear your woolen sweater. Okay, the place that we're going to is called the Mickey Mouse. It was a Jordanian police station. And the reason it's called the Mickey Mouse, you'll see when you get close to it, is because it has two very distinctive chambers on either end that are like round. And from the air, it looks like a big Mickey Mouse. So they called it Mickey Mouse. There was a big battle there in the Six-Day War. And we took the position back. It used to be an army base. In fact, I once served there. And then eventually the people in this area wanted to take it over for better purposes. So the army agreed to give it up. They created a base next door. And at this point, it is a center for Judaica for the area. And artisans, artists, silversmiths, jewelers, etc., they all sort of display their wares there. What we're going to do when we get there is we have a nothing fancy pizza lunch. Then you'll have a little chance to shop. And then there's a woman who is an incredible woman who used to run the Judaica Center. She recently retired. She's doing other things right now. She lost her son in Shechem during Operation Chomat Magen. And they made a video about him. And she has a presentation. And just the chance to meet someone like this, who's really an American, who came to Israel, and to hear her story, it's a very powerful experience. And that's why we're going to eat lunch beforehand, because like you'll feel funny sitting at a pizza lunch after talking to her. I saw the most amazing article. It was published in the Journal of Acupuncture, okay, which just came out. Like they have like this, I don't know, bi-yearly thing. And it was a study of tefillin. And they discovered it's a Chinese publication, and the Chinese invented acupuncture. And they discovered, they did a study of the pressure points that are affected by wearing the tefillin on the hand and the head. And they discovered, it's amazing, I'll send it to you. They discovered that that all the pressure points that they believe you put needles into in order to activate and allow a person to reach their highest levels of spirituality are exactly the pressure points that the tefillin hits.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? It's unbelievable. Just so you know, this road that we're on, the straightest road in the area, this was the airfield that they were speaking about. They turned this into an airfield in 48. And they managed to get some supplies that day, that way. Realized that back then, the sum totality of the Israeli Air Force was 3 Piper Cubs. So a third of the Air Force would land every time that Cub landed. And they were so protective of it, it wouldn't actually stop usually. It would slow down, they would run alongside, they would throw out the boxes, and then it would take off because they were terrified that the Arabs would see it and would lie sort of waiting for them in ambush. And this is Alon Shvut, again, on our left, which is the community that was founded. Somebody asked me before, just so you understand, there were 4 communities here. Okay, 3 of them, the people were captured, and they were taken to Jordan, where they were prisoners of war for a year before they were released. And when those people got out, you know, unlike Kfar Etzion, all the men survived. They wanted to rebuild communities somewhere else. This may be an experience that we get to see again, unfortunately, this summer. But they didn't want to like move into Tel Aviv, and they wanted to stay as a community. So they got land near the sea, near Ashkelon, and Rivadim reestablished itself there. Masu'ot Yitzchak did as well, and so did Ein Terim. In 1967, we came back, so Kfar Etzion was reestablished by the children who had survived, because there were no men to build one back in 48. The children of those who built Ein Terim decided to come back here as well, and they built something called Rosh Terim, okay? And Masorot and Rivadim stayed near Ashkelon. Okay, we're now going to go into a Judaica center. Give us a second to find out exactly where lunch is. Meanwhile, you can browse around the Judaica center. On the left is what is now the army base. This used to be a Jordanian position. בסדר, אם תרצה לאכול איתנו פיצה, אז בכיף.
לא, אני אכלתי כבר.
בסדר, אוקיי. Let me go make sure this set up. Here, people want to sit at a table. We'll eat like minches. You want to do me a favor, Yuri?
Yeah.
Can you get me a slice of pizza? Thanks, ma'am. Yeah, well, what is Palestine, first of all? The word Palestinian is a ridiculous word.
I know.
They're Arabs. There's nothing wrong with that. Palestine is a name that was made up by the Romans after Hadrian decided to destroy every last vestige of Jewish nation. Pardon? Around 135, right? And he called it Palestine, sort of a throwback to the Philistines, to make a kind of a statement, this is not your land, and you're done, you're out of here. It was not to deny that it had ever been our land. Right? Rome did not have a problem making a statement that they were taking someone else's land. That's what Rome did. Right? But, so they came up with the name Palestine. You couldn't say the word Israel. Okay? And for the, and of course the Christian church took over the Roman Empire. So this became the name. Palestine.
How did they come up with the name?
Now Arabs, the Muslims and the Christians, they were at war with each other. So on Arab maps, from, you know, even 800, 700 years ago, you don't see the word Palestine, because that's a Christian word. And that demonstrates that it belongs to the Christians. So they called it Israel, its original name. Yeah, so the Arabs
called it Israel?
Mm-hmm. You do not find the word Palestine in the Quran. Right? Only the land of Israel. And it's barely mentioned. You don't find it all mentioned in the word Jerusalem. One of the only places Israel is mentioned is to make the statement, Surah, I don't know, 65, I think, that it's the land of the Jews. So now, that's the first issue. The concept of a Palestine is a ridiculous concept to begin with. It certainly has nothing to do with the Philistines. This place was never called Palestine before the year 200 CE. And the Philistines lived here around about 1,000 before the Common Era, like 1,200 years earlier. So why did the Arabs like the name Palestine? Because Philistines. So they could claim to be descendants of the Philistines, which is equally ridiculous. That's one of the points that Israeli archaeologists, even the most left-wing liberals, all agree on, that it's ridiculous. That's A. B, even if you call this place Palestine, what's a Palestinian?
Mm-hmm.
A Palestinian is someone who's born in the state of Palestine, right? So if you're Jewish, and you're born in 1945 in Israel.
Yeah.
It wasn't called Israel yet.
You're a Palestinian.
You're a Palestinian. So my mother-in-law, who's Israeli, was born in 1945 in Israel, in Rehovot, and on her original passport it says Palestine. She is the original Palestinian, right? Now back then, how do you define a Palestinian? Third question is, what about today? Like for example, if you live in America, and you're Jewish, are you Israeli? You're Israeli. If you come here, I'm Israeli. I'm Israeli-American, American-Israeli. And you're American, and that's okay. Why are you American? Because you were born in America. Now, your father was born in America, both your parents, your grandparents. Where are they from? So why aren't you Russian? You're Russian. You're not a Russian because you didn't grow up in Russia, you weren't born there, and you don't live there. Right? You could call yourself part of the Russian community, Russian heritage, but you're not Russian. So the definition of someone's identity is where they were born, where they lived. Now what happens if you're living someplace and you get kicked out? You're forced to leave. Well, you leave. Running from persecution. So if you're Vietnamese and you live in Vietnam and you're forced to flee because of the war, you're a Vietnamese refugee because you lived in Vietnam. Let's say you come to America. You're a Vietnamese refugee. What about your children? They're born in America. Are they Vietnamese or Americans? You're Vietnamese, and you live in Vietnam. The war breaks out. You're terrified. So you manage to sneak onto a boat and get to America. Now you're in America. You're not an American citizen. You weren't born in America. You're a Vietnamese refugee. You make it. You have a family. Okay. Now you live in Vietnam. Now you have children.
You live in America.
You live in America. Your children are born in Chicago. And you live in Chicago. They're born in New York. Are they Vietnamese or are they American? Why? Because they're born in America. Now, I could make a case for that generation. You could call them Vietnamese Americans. They probably still speak a lot of Vietnamese. What about their children?
American.
Yeah. Everywhere in the world, that's the rule. Everywhere in the world, you're a refugee if you're forced to leave a country, okay? And if you claim to be a refugee, if you're born in a country and you're forced to leave, okay? But the next generation born in a new country is no longer considered a refugee. Now, there is an exception to that rule for one generation if they are in refugee camps. Then they're called refugees, they're just not called Vietnamese anymore. But they're refugees, but that lasts one generation. Third generation, they're not refugees. The United Nations passed a law granting special status to the Arab refugees. They were still called Arabs back then. Arafat coined the name Palestinian in 1965. Before 65, you will not find mention of Palestinian refugees. Do not find it, right? So in 1951, the United Nations passed a law, the Arab refugees are considered refugees and have refugee status, father to son, until they return to their homeland. Now that's a unique law that applies only to Arab refugees and no one else. So if you're the great-great-grandson of an Arab refugee who was forced to leave Israel, forget for the moment whose fault that was. You're still a refugee. That's why the Arabs claim that there are 4 million Arab refugees. But what's an Arab refugee? It means that you grew up in Jordan, your parents grew up in Jordan, and your grandfather left Jordan, and your children, who were just born, are still refugees. Right? And my daughter's 15 years old, okay? And my mother-in-law would be, if she was Arab, an Arab refugee. And since my daughter's 15, you know, in the Arab world, she'd be getting married and having children in a couple of years. So in a couple of years, you'd have great-grandchildren that are still called Arab refugees. They've never been to Israel or Jaffa or whatever. They don't know what it looks like. They don't speak the language. They don't know anything. Israel, by the common law definition of refugees, estimates there are about 100,000 legitimate Arab refugees left. The Arabs claim 4 million, and the number keeps growing year to year. And the world just buys it because it's a sexy number. The most, by the way, there are two points that are the most horrifying points. One point is, look, we had 850,000 refugees came from Arab lands. We resettled them, we repopulated them, etc. Why are there 4 million people who are wallowing in refugee camps? Let's ask yourself a simple question. Saudi Arabia's gross national product now, okay, if I'm not mistaken, is something to the tune of $37 billion. $37 billion. Be like in touch with that number. It's just unbelievable. Okay? Why are they... So how can the Saudis scream about how we're occupying the Palestinians, which is not true anyway? Okay? In fact, that's another point. In 1993, between 1993 and 1995, we pulled out of basically 95% of all the Arab towns in Israel. We haven't been running Ramallah, Jenin, Hebron, we're out of there. The army is out of there. So for those 7 years, why weren't the Arabs building up the infrastructure? Where did all the money go? And they discovered that Yasser Arafat, I mean, so at a certain point, the Israelis have the right to say, you know what, we're done. Like, this is ridiculous. You know, one little Jewish country, there's 22 Arab countries, you know. Oh, Shalom Aleichem. How are you doing? All right, I'm going to gather my troops together. I figured it'd be smarter to eat before you spoke to them. We're going to go upstairs and hear this presentation. Whoever's here from Israelite, come on upstairs. You're in for an experience. You're going to watch a presentation on that screen. Just by way of introduction, I had the privilege of meeting Cheryl a good number of years ago. We're basically neighbors. The Mandels, Meir Aliyah, live in Alunshvut, which is one of the communities that we passed. And Cheryl used to run the Judaica Center here up until, a year ago, something like that? 3 months ago, okay. Seems like a year since you began, right? And so we kind of connected. Cheryl actually is an unwitting partner to sponsoring an Israelite student, because there's a custom that goes on in like the tourism industries, you know, when a tour guide or a bus driver would take a group somewhere, and the group goes and they buy stuff and whatever it might be. So generally speaking, you know, the place, out of recognition that they want these people to come back, so they usually give like the bus driver and sometimes the tour guide like a percentage, which is reasonable and ethical. I didn't know anything about this because I'm not a tour guide, right? I'm just doing this for fun. So the first time we came here, so Cheryl came over to me, And we finished the group. The group's getting on the bus, and I'm just kind of hustling the last person. She comes over with an envelope. So I didn't understand what the envelope was. I thought it was a bill for something or whatever. And I get back on the bus, and I see it's cash. So I run back inside. I said, I don't understand what this is. Is this owed to somebody? So she explained to me this whole process. And she also told me that I should be careful because half of it is supposed to go to the bus driver, right? So I didn't want to take any of this. So we kind of came to an agreement, which was that whenever she did this, which she's not doing today, and they're not doing today, so don't worry about that. But for that year that she insisted on doing it, we basically took it and put it in a fund. And after about, I don't know, a year's worth or 2 years' worth of tours, there's basically enough in there that we sponsored an Israelite student who came to Israelite based on the groups that shopped there, which I thought was very interesting. And 1 year I was actually able to bring a birthright group, and there was a student who had wanted to do birthright, but she wasn't eligible, so we took that scholarship money, and she joined the group, and she got to meet the girl that they had sponsored there. Anyway, that's how we became friendly. And a little while ago, two years and three months. And how many days and how many hours? Cheryl became a member and her family of a very unfortunate group that nobody really wants to join, which is the families who have lost sons in the army. And her son Daniel fell in battle. I'll let her tell you the story. And it's not often that you meet someone who's willing to share. And you can't come to Israel and see what you're seeing without at least getting a taste of what that is. So this is not an easy thing for her to do, but I asked her if she'd be willing. The family kind of put together this film sort of in memory, and Cheryl has graciously agreed to share it with us and to talk to us about it. So. When an energy comes into the world and it comes to us as a gift, we make the mistake of thinking that it's the physical person. When you get to know a person, you know the physical is just a small part of it.
Yeah.
Like that's our struggle, that this person physically isn't here. But what they brought to the world, their energy, their spirit, their neshama, that's still very much with us.
Yeah.
So it's a mitzvah that came to the world for a reason, that reason should live. So the mitzvah of bringing it into the world, that was his mitzvah. Right? So the mitzvah of what that gift becomes, you know, so he did his job. His job was to bring whatever he had to bring the world in.
Well, that's what David
so if you
says,
can put that out into the world, that's a, yeah.
That's what David says. David said he had a purpose, he fulfilled his purpose, then he went on.
Listen, I can tell you one place that they'll definitely read this. That I can tell you.
Israelite.
What he did.
We have that movie.
It would be something that
you know what I've always thought is so sad?
Yom
HaZikaron, all that stuff, all of it.
Yeah.
They should be
mm-hmm.
seeing that overseas. I don't understand why.
We have the movie. You know, like what I think, you have the movie Nachan, and I know you thought that's Yom HaZikaron.
Did you see the tachnit of, what was his name, Salamanov?
Gold.
Evelyn Salamanov is a woman, she's actually divorced, who taught in Pittsburgh, so we know her. She taught in Pittsburgh when I was in Pittsburgh. And her son was also, he was killed by a sniper outside Jenin.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed their story. And her ex-husband, his father, this boy had problems with his feet. So he never finished the Masai. He never did the Masai Kumtai. It always bothered him. But, you know, Sedus, he didn't do the Masai Kumtai. He was a sniper. Yeah. And so after he died, he was killed. His father wanted to do the Masai Kumtai for him, and they wouldn't let him. So he trained for 2 years until they finally passed him in the physical. He was 58 years old.
Wow.
They televised it. And he did the Masai Kumtai with them. I mean, he didn't carry all the gear, and he inspired these soldiers, and they talk about it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And it was on, and those types of things where you see Americans and they're talking, it makes it real.
Right.
You know.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.